This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The digital age in which we can show others real-time what's going on in our lives has been a watershed moment in how America talks about police misconduct. Law enforcement abuses have been documented all across the nation. For some, it raises a new level of awareness. For others, these moments are validations of what's been going on for so very long. A new exhibition suggests a more systemic way of exploring these problems rather than just scrolling through your feeds. Matt Lassiter is a history professor at the University of Michigan. He's the founder and director of the Policing and Social Justice History Lab. He's also the lead author and editor of an online exhibit called Detroit Under Fire that catalogs abuses by Detroit police from 1957 through 1973. Matt, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for inviting me.
So what we're talking about here is a series of online experiences that you and the team have pulled together. And these include some show-stopping photographs, artifacts from newspapers of the period, lots and lots of narratives and information in text form, maps, some data graphics. Can you start out by telling us how you began to think about expressing police violence in this way rather than in some other format, by like maybe just publishing a book?
So this project began after the Michael Brown killing in Ferguson, Missouri. And we were thinking about how to contribute to the Black Lives Matter motivated debate that the country was having, and in particular to provide historical context for the larger patterns and processes. And so we decided to mobilize undergraduate researchers in particular, and to try to figure out the answers to a question that has been deliberately kept silent, which is, how many people did the Detroit Police Department kill during the civil rights era? It's impossible to even know that basic information. Who were they? What happened? What are the larger patterns of police brutality, misconduct, just interactions with the Black community in a northern city during this time period, and what are its legacies?
Can I ask how your conversation with the students and just sort of how the shape of the project, how it was informed by what is or isn't reported in the media?
So we started out heading into the archives, and we did inventory the newspapers to the best that we could, but most of the time, what you can find in the newspapers, if you find anything at all during this period, was a very brief report that was just the police version of what happened. So it would say, Negro, 19 years old, was shot by the Detroit Police Department while running from the scene of a crime. And often there would be almost nothing else. And so we decided that we wanted to, first of all, try to figure out as many of these stories as we could. We headed to the archives at Wayne State University, which has an amazing collection of civil rights and labor history, the Detroit Public Library, which has a lot of the mayor's papers. And we tried to dig up as much information as we could beyond what you can find in the daily newspapers. And what we found is that although the police department records are sealed and very hard to get into, whenever the community would protest, whenever a family would really push a case, or the NAACP or a Black Power group would start a mass movement, then the mayor would tend to get the police department file, the Homicide Bureau report. And we also found a lot of information in the files of the city's civil rights agency, the Detroit Commission on Community Relations, until 1968. And after 1968, the police department stonewalled the Detroit Commission on Community Relations completely, refused to share any information with them. And so that really ran cold right at the moment when the police department in Detroit really escalated its use of fatal force. But we just tried to gather as much as we could. I want to make one thing really clear. Almost everything that we've documented on our exhibit was documented during the 1960s and 1970s. By civil rights and Black Power organizations, and by the people in the communities who were most impacted by this. And what we did was just go try to find the work that they had already done and bring it back to the public and make it available to those communities as well.
You turned up a lot. And some of these incidents are stories that people might remember or know something about, and some of it feels like very fresh data. There's one statistic that you compiled that during a 7-year period from 1967 to 1973, more than 100 unarmed Black people were killed by the Detroit police. And even if people knew the scope of the problem, that fact is just, it's so stark and it's so awful to see. Was it hard to put together a number like that? Could you maybe take us through, you know, what it took to even get to that sentence?
So I think this is a conservative estimate because much of the information we have is still just the newspaper report. But as a broader goal of this project, we would like to see the Wayne County prosecutor and the Michigan state government make all of these records available, that when the state kills somebody and there's an investigation, that should be public. Communities demanded it at the time, and they often didn't get it. But here's how we went at this. First of all, we did a pattern analysis assessment as best we could, getting as much information as we could from the archives and from media reports. I think what we found is just the tip of the iceberg. The 100 unarmed people shot in the 7-year period is an estimate. And there are about 15 cases where the official police version is that those unarmed people had knives, but we are classifying them as unarmed because there is a huge amount of evidence that police officers carried knives. They were called drop knives so that they could use them to frame somebody in the event of a questionable or wrongful shooting. And the police officer who participated in the killing of 8 to 10 people during the early 1970s was proved to have framed his final victim by planting a knife on him after shooting him down. And there's a lot of evidence that people were framed. They were said to be armed when they weren't. But even putting that aside, the police department, as official policy, encouraged officers to shoot unarmed and fleeing, quote unquote, suspects. And the department allowed this before 1967, but did not actively encourage it. And during the 1967 uprising, often called the Detroit Riot, the police department and the National Guard shot and killed more than 30 Black people, mostly young males, for allegedly looting, often shooting into a group of people, unarmed. And the policy said that you couldn't shoot and kill somebody unless there was no other way to apprehend the fleeing fugitive. And after 1967, the police department changed that policy and said that the decision of whether the shooting was justified would rest in this quote unquote sound discretion of the police officer. And this was part of a larger surge throughout the country in the late 60s and beyond to put authority to use fatal force in the discretionary split-second judgment of a police officer. And so in the next 5 to 6 years, the Detroit Police Department then encouraged fatal force against unarmed, fleeing, alleged robbers and burglars.
In what way?
The clearest evidence that the department encouraged this was the formation of the stress unit, Stop the Robberies, Enjoy Safe Streets, in the early 1970s. And the stress unit, its official justification was that it was going to protect Black citizens from street crime because they suffered the most. And statistically, that's true. Black citizens did suffer the most from street crime. But stress was an undercover decoy unit. Almost all of the undercover officers were white. And it's really preposterous to protect Black citizens with an undercover decoy unit of white officers. And they also deployed mainly in the parts of the city that were gentrifying, the Cass Corridor, which now is called Midtown Detroit. It's where the museums and Wayne State University, and it's where white, you know, suburbanites go into the city now to go to breweries. And this was about really policing the color line. Many of the people shot and killed by stress, civil rights and Black power groups proved, were not even involved in a crime. And this was an active policy. The commander of Stress said that what is at stake here is whether we can, quote unquote, police the Black community. And it was really a response to the very clear sign that the demographics were changing and that soon African Americans would be a majority in Detroit, would elect a mayor, would be able to have control to some extent over the police department. And white neighborhoods were demanding that the line be held, the segregation line. And the police department was an instrument in this effort to maintain white control of a segregated city. And what we found in our mapping is that a huge percentage of the fatal force incidents, as many other kinds of police brutality and misconduct, including racial profiling and stop and frisk, happen along the color line. They happen in white neighborhoods bordering Black neighborhoods. They happen in commercial districts. The police were not going into the poorest Black communities that were called the highest crime areas very much during this period. They weren't really protecting those communities from crime at all. They were defending the color line with fatal force and other types of police violence.
Can I ask, how did you talk to the students about officer narratives and departmental narratives of this time? Because, I mean, on the one hand, I could see taking on this project with the understanding that there needs to be a wider lens on this than what the official record has to tell us. But on the other hand, were there some details that you wouldn't have gotten any other way? Or did you see some value in explaining things the way that officers explain them?
So it's a complicated project to take undergraduate students into the archives like this. And we try to do a few things. We interviewed a former Black police officer in Detroit, Ike McKinnon, who actually went on to become the chief of police. And he told us his perspective as both an officer and as a Black kid growing up in Detroit who was brutalized by the police. And he has talked about this incident a lot, who remembered the crash crackdown of 1959, 1960, when the police department illegally arrested 1,500 African-American males as murder suspects, and they all had murder suspect on their permanent record. And he told us these stories, and he also told us what it was like to be a police officer when you witnessed brutality. He told us a story about witnessing brutality by white officers and reporting it and having the hierarchy say, don't tell us about this. Do you want your career to be over? And so we tried to get that perspective. We didn't have time in the initial phase of the project to do a lot of interviews, but this project is continuing. And one of the things that we want to do is interview more people, interview the family members of people who are impacted and the rest. But when you're leading students in a history project, you know, the best history is a history that gets as many perspectives as you can. And I want to emphasize that our website has about 1,500 archival documents on it. And we would put the newspaper reports on it too, but that's a copyright problem. And we want to allow viewers of the website to read through the documents and make their own determinations. Every Freedom of Information Act file that we get, we're putting the whole thing on the website and breaking it down into all of its different parts. And so we offer our interpretations, but we're also designing a curriculum. And this is available for the public, for impacted families and communities to go through, for police officers too, to go through and really look at the documents that we found, make their own determinations. People are welcome to send us more documents and accounts, and we'll put those on the website as well.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking today with University of Michigan Professor Matt Lassiter. He's founder and director of the Policing and Social Justice History Lab, and also is the lead author and editor of an online exhibit called Detroit Under Fire. It catalogs Detroit police abuses from 1957 through 1973. There's so much here, but there was something that jumped out at me that I wanted to ask you about, and that's research the team did about violence against women. Can you tell us a little bit about what you found?
We found an enormous amount of violence against women, and I think scholars and activists have increasingly been arguing that violence against Black women in particular has been undercounted in this country because, you know, 90% or more of the people incarcerated are males. The mass incarceration debate has centered largely around Black males, Latinx males. And what we found going back into Detroit is that the police department was particularly brutal against Black women in the following ways. First of all, against sex workers, so-called prostitutes. There was massive police corruption around the sex trade and around the drug trade during this period. And one of the most important incidents in Detroit's history was the killing of Cynthia Scott, a young Black female sex worker who was shot in the back by a white officer when she refused to submit to an illegal arrest. And then he planted a knife on her and he was exonerated. There were massive protests. And what makes this so important is that it was the first time in the 1960s when the majority of the protesters in the streets were poor and working class people, because this hit home. This was in a so-called vice district. This affected people who were working in the underground economy. And it was a real turning point in Detroit's history because it helped bring radical activists and organizations to the forefront of the police brutality movement. The other major patterns of violence against women that we documented were the police department pulled hundreds of thousands of motorists over every year in racial profiling incidents, often when they were in white neighborhoods or just downtown. And if Black people complained about that and asserted their constitutional rights, they would often get brutalized in response. And so we have a lot of incidents of Black women who are in cars and they protest the deprivation of their constitutional rights, and the reaction is violence. And the other major category that we found, well, two really, Black mothers who complained about brutality against their sons and filed formal complaints were often targeted for abuse, wrongful arrest, retaliatory violence. And we've documented this based on their own protest accounts in a number of cases. And then Black female political activists, especially young Black women who were involved in Black power movements in high schools and colleges, were also targeted for police violence.
What did you find out about whether officers involved in these cases ever faced criminal charges?
Oh, it almost never happened. The thing about the discretionary use of force standard that you could shoot somebody when they're fleeing is a lot of the incidents were technically justifiable under that standard. But if you did a wrongful shooting or just killed somebody, murdered somebody, it was a self-exoneration script. You just said that they were fleeing and you suspected them of being a burglar. And the police department set up an internal investigative process in the 60s in response to civil rights protests. The civil rights groups wanted a civilian review board that would be elected and independent, and they didn't get that. They never got that. But the police department set up an internal investigative process, and they just whitewashed investigations systematically. We documented that no police officer was fired during the 1960s for any incident. And, you know, we're talking about felony level assault and worse, so many incidents, mass brutality against nonviolent civil rights activists, the kind of story that we think is a Southern story, but it happened in Detroit over and over again. And the police department, the Homicide Bureau, the internal investigative agency, and the Wayne County prosecutor almost never did anything. And here's the most striking finding. If they never took the word of a Black person or even 10 Black people over the word of a white officer, if 8 Black witnesses said this person was unarmed and that officer just shot them dead for no reason, and one officer and his partner said, "We were attacked with a knife. I was defending myself." They always took the word of white officers. They almost never took the word of white citizens over white officers, but there just weren't as many incidents. They just didn't. In the early to mid 60s, the investigations would call Black witnesses biased. And what they mean in the Cynthia Scott investigation, for example, when six African-American witnesses said she was shot and framed, the investigation said they were biased, but they were biased because they were Black. The idea was that they couldn't be expected to give truthful testimony because they were also Black people, and therefore they were disqualified from being legal witnesses. I mean, it's really quite extraordinary. And the prosecutor deserves an enormous amount of responsibility for the violence in Detroit during this time, but so does the mayor, and so do the white neighborhoods, which openly called for these kind of crackdowns. Thousands of letters to the mayor that we discovered demanding tough policing, demanding a stop and frisk law, which Detroit passed in 1968, opposing a civilian review board and saying, if we put handcuffs on the police, then Black criminals will run rampant throughout our city. But mostly what the police were doing was harassing regular people as they went about their daily business and illegally cracking down on political activists. That's what they spent a huge amount of their time doing during the 1960s.
Matt, what do you feel like we gain when we look at these interactions in through such a macro lens? I think some people might take all this in and say, I wish I knew more about the individual interactions, which in many cases, I guess we'll just never know. But what do you think is gained by looking at the big picture in this way?
What we've documented is only the tip of the iceberg. And the vast majority of encounters never made it into the archive. You know, the extent of this is unknowable. What we gain, first of all, I think, is an appreciation that the urban North was not the opposite of the Jim Crow South during this period. It was the Jim Crow North. And scholars and activists have been arguing this for a long time, but it is difficult for our country, for white Americans, that it's comforting to think that the worst racism was in Mississippi and Alabama. But the level of police violence in Detroit, I doubt any Southern city police department killed nearly as many Black people as the Detroit Police Department, the Chicago Police Department, the Los Angeles Police Department did during the civil rights era. So police violence was systemic. By mapping, we've shown that it was along the color line. It was not about crime control. It was about racial control. It was about infiltration, surveillance, and crackdowns on political activists. It was political police violence. And the second thing that I think we gain is an appreciation for how vibrant and longstanding the resistance movement against this racialized police violence has been. The George Floyd protests or the Michael Brown Black Lives Matter surge brought new attention to this, as if this was a new thing, a kind of next stage of the civil rights movement, to have police be the target. But during the 1960s and 1970s, police brutality was in some ways the most important campaign for civil rights and Black power activists at particular moments. They saw the police, along with housing segregation, employment discrimination, school segregation, as part of an apparatus of racial control. And we went into this project to document police violence. But what we also ended up documenting, and many other scholars have done this as well, is an incredible outpouring of activism, because most of the evidence we could find was created by these activists at the time. And then the third important point for what this project shows is that the discretionary procedures and cover-up processes that are allowing police violence to flourish today and that are under attack by activists were largely put in place during the 1960s and 1970s in response to that activist challenge to unchecked police violence. The removal of legal responsibility from individual officers, the qualified immunity, the investigative processes that were opaque and invisible to the public, the use of force guidelines that put total discretion in the officer. Those were created for political and racial control reasons in response to demands during the 1960s and 1970s for community control and civilian oversight over the police.
Matt Lassiter, professor of history at U of M and the founder and director of the Policing and Social Justice History Lab. Detroit Under Fire is online right now, and you can look through all of its offerings. Matt, how long do you expect the online exhibition will be? Is this something that will be up in perpetuity?
Oh, this is permanent. This is the equivalent of a book. So it'll be up for, you know, until the web platforms go away and we have to redesign it. We have a second one coming out next year called Crackdown that takes the story from 1974 to 1993. And we're also looking backward toward the incredible police violence of the Prohibition of Alcohol era and also World War II in Detroit. And then we also have a lot of specialized reports and curricular products for people who don't have the time to go through the entire website, which is as long as a book and has tons of documents. So we have some more focused products as well.
Well, thank you very much for talking to us about this.
Thanks so much for letting us share these resources with you and your listeners.